Thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium Session 164, titled Mindfully Navigating Grief and Loss Within Faith, Awakenings. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. This video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months beginning at the end of August 2020. Please type your questions into the Whova app to be addressed during the question answering at the end of the presentation. Due to time constraints, Sarah is also taking questions via email, and her email is in the Q&A section of the Whova app. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There's more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, a faith awakening transition can usher in unique experiences with grief and loss. At times, a loss of identity, certainty, and connection to a community can occur. In this session, we will utilize the latest grief and loss research to explore how faith transitions can help us more mindfully manage the cyclical nature and non-finite aspect of grief and loss. We will highlight the complexity of grief often experienced in mixed faith marriages and mixed faith families. Concrete suggestions will be offered for creating stress reduction plans and fostering support systems to reduce the chronic sorrow often associated with ongoing instances of loss and religious spiritual difference. I will take a second to introduce you to our speaker before we begin. Sarah Hughes Zabawa is a licensed clinical social worker, certified Daring Way facilitator, and wellness coach working with Symmetry Solutions to offer in-person and online therapy and wellness coaching. Sarah often works with individuals, couples, and families who are impacted by a shift in their spiritual beliefs and who are seeking support in entering this new awakening with a better balance, healthier boundaries, and improved trust in themselves moving forward in a meaningful way. I will now give the floor over to Sarah.
Thank you so much, Anne. This is probably the most accurate introduction to my life. This photo is taken in the midst of our COVID shutdown as a family, and I wanted that level of hot mess is kind of what you're going to see today. I'm so sincerely grateful to be here with you. Sunstone has been such an important part of my personal journey for healing and grief management and my own faith awakening. And at the same time, we're all coming together in this really, really unique space, and technology is not my strength. So thank you for your love and patience. Also, because this photo is pretty indicative of the last few months, I recognized only a half an hour ago that I presented an hour and a half presentation for an hour. So this level of hot mess you see right here with two working parents, with two little kids and no childcare support, we're going to practice our grief skill sets here and sit in the tension and ask for grace and self-acceptance. So if this feels like we're going to go a little faster because I won't be able to share all of the content on each slide, I want you to just take a deep breath with me. I'm going to say take one too. And I'm developing this information into a course that will have much more information. It'll be at a slower pace, and we'll also have a workbook. So this is both a beginning and what I hope to be a valuable use of your hour. And I am so grateful that you're here. And I only wish I could see you and hug you. And as an extrovert, the challenges of COVID are so real. My sincere hope can be summed up by a quote by Rumi. Your grief for what you've lost lifts a mirror up to what you're bravely working on. My sincere hope together, and my sincere hope for our clients and my clients, is that we can normalize the grief process. Believe it or not, grief is adaptive. It honors the loss and the significance of our losses. Grief is both healthy and an adaptive response. And yet, because we come from a more Mormon culture that is still grappling with the reality and the developmental normalcy of faith development, faith awakening, and faith transition, sometimes we don't have the permission to truthfully allow ourselves to honor our grief process with love, compassion, and significance. And so I just want to simply ask you to take a quiet moment and consider, what has your grief brought forward? What has it been its mirror in what you are bravely working towards? Just think about that. I am bravely working forward in my own grief, knowing that I am a partner in this process with you. I am a professional, a mental health therapist and coach. I am simply your sister also in this grief dance, and I want to have and name the honesty and vulnerability that we are in this all together. So what is this mirror allowing you to look bravely at? For me, it's sitting with the reality that some things that I would hope would change might never change, and I'm having to work with that wrestle. I'd like you to take a moment, because your needs matter. My clients will know that's something I really advocate for. Write down or consider in your heart, what is one or two of the hopes you have for your participation today? And I want to have a sincere invitation that if we don't cover a question or a hope of yours, please reach out. We are not meant to do this alone. And because of the nature of going a little more quickly through the content, I really have a sincere invitation to please reach out with questions, both at the end of today and moving forward. So why are we here? So oftentimes the questions I've asked myself and the questions that I receive from clients is, why does this faith awakening hurt so bad? Why isn't it getting easier? When will the grieving process end? And I want to create a space in our conversation today by taking aspects of the research on grief that is emerging and new, and allow us to really consider why it's hurting, to honor the significance of our grief, and understand the cyclical nature of what's coming forward, especially within a faith awakening in a more fundamentalist religious practice like Mormonism. I love this quote by Kenneth Branagh. I think it's probably important to acknowledge and recognize that grief is a reaction to loss. We often confuse it as a reaction to death. But we can also experience when we lose any significant form of attachment. I want to read that last sentence again. We can also experience it when we lose any significant form of attachment. Let's look at what the loss of attachment can look like for a faith awakener, a nuanced believer, a believing spouse, a family member. Without reading the whole list, ask yourself, where have you experienced a loss of attachment or a fear of a loss of attachment? A lot of us are wrestling with a different and unique relationship with the institution. Our beliefs have changed. Our jobs might be threatened if we're working for the church. Our God, has there been a loss of attachment to certainty, the afterlife, our purpose? And what so often we see in family dynamics is a disruption or a fear of disruption in attachment, understanding, intimacy, emotional integrity with our spouse, siblings, family members, and parents. So I just want to, when you look at the enormity of what a faith awakening includes regarding loss, could we have some additional love and compassion that it takes time, that it hurts, and that it's incredibly complicated? I want to honor, too, that the different severity can come in different levels of attachment. So, for example, if our attachment to the institution was never very important, Our identity wasn't wrapped into it. Our sense of loss, our level of grief might be different. So significance of our attachment can give us a different window into the severity of our grief. I'm someone who wants to get literal. Like, I want to take the research and put it straight into examples in our lives. So let's look at the parallel process of the fear of attachment, the fear of loss of attachment in all different areas of those who might be attending today. So for those in a faith awakening process or faith transitioner, there's been potentially huge shifts in attachment within the religious institution. And once again, there's a heightened fear of loss of attachment with community, family, and friends. There's a loss of certainty or literal belief for our nuanced members, right? They're attending and yet they can't go backwards. They can't not know what they know. They want to be there. There's a loss of certainty and at the same time, a loss of awareness and sense of community and awareness. For believing spouses, this can be the death of a dream. That there can be a shift in shared religious behaviors, spiritual practices, emotional intimacy. And both with believing spouses and believing family members, so much of the fear of attachment related to the life after can come forward and complicate our grief. What I think is so important when we look at grief within a family system, because we are hardwired for connection, we are part of different systems, sometimes if we like it or not, is that there is a parallel process happening here. There is a fear of loss or grappling with the reality of loss. And I just want to ask you, are you your best self in the midst of fear? I'm sure I am not my best self in this state of fear. And so oftentimes if we understand what we're fearing and what losses we're experiencing, we can understand why people are acting the way they are. I want to talk really briefly about the research. Why does this matter? Because research regarding grief and loss is developing at a rapid pace. And I was at a research conference, which is why all of this came forward for me. It was a grief conference. And I really recognize, because I work so often with faith awakening and faith transition in families, I'm like, where's the literature? Like, we need more research here. We need more research for my people, for my friends, for my loved ones, for myself. And so I want to talk to you about what's available and what's emerging, because it matters and it normalizes our experience and it gives us context to understand why does this hurt so bad, if that's your experience. I want to name that we're going to talk about ambiguous grief first. Ambiguous grief is a loss that remains unclear and thus without resolution. The external situation of a relationship is ruptured by ambiguity, the lack of certainty about the loved one's presence or absence. So the two most common types of ambiguous grief are type one, grieving a person who is physically absent but psychologically present. Examples of that most commonly discussed in research are deployment, immigration, incarceration, divorce. What we're starting to recognize is the emergence of estrangement and disownment. And when you think about our Jehovah Witness brothers and sisters, their faith awakenings or transitions from their faith literally means estrangement and disownment. So someone is physically absent, but in our hearts, in our minds, they are with us and yet not. And it complicates our grief experience. The second most common type is grieving a person who is physically present but psychologically absent. Think about that as chronic illness, chronic mental illness. For those of you in the audience who've taken care of a loved one with Alzheimer's or dementia, they are there in person and in body, but at the same time, you are missing parts of them that you loved the most. Or that you loved and missed. What we're beginning to see is the research has space for what many faith awakeners experience regarding the dark night of the soul, which is like if you're in a mixed faith marriage and you're the partner having a faith awakening You're there. You're alive. You haven't left. And at the same time, you are mind, body, spirit. Your presence, your sense of self is disrupted. In the dark nights of my soul, I am not fully there, right? There's deep grief that's coming forward. So this is examples of ambiguous grief. The ambiguous grief that got me so excited and where I'm really recognizing this is where we're going to go in our research, where we need to go in our research as a community and where I want to go professionally is there's an ambiguous grief 2.5. We're not even like fully at 3 yet, team. We're just at 2.5, which is a grieving person who is physically present. We're alive. We're here. But has had an identity change and at the same time is expected to be who they always were. Now, the research has seen this given examples of PTS and grief. For example, a family member who has a death of a child. There is both this expectation that they're supposed to be the same person, move through the same functions, serve in the same way, and yet the reality is they've been deeply and forever changed. We're also seeing this work really beautifully in understanding our transgender family and gender transitions in relationship to family, right? There is an awareness that this person is both their child and different than they imagined. So it's this wrestle between you are still here and yet you are different and yet I want you to be the same. This is ambiguous grief 2.5. Now what the research is just starting to acknowledge, and this is what I'm getting so excited about, is there is a significant shift in religious belief or religious conversion. For those of you who are a convert, you might have experienced the grief of loss, of people's disappointment in you joining Mormonism. It's the parallel process of someone who's choosing to leave. And the reason that this is so complicated and why it's painful, one is because culturally within Mormonism and within our religious community, there hasn't been permission for there to be a resolution. There hasn't been permission that this is valid, healthy, good, worthy, which makes it ambiguous. And one of the most important hallmark signs of ambiguous grief is it defies resolution. We want to fix it. We want to change it. We want to make it different for someone else. We want them to be the person they once were, or maybe we want to be the person we once were. And yet, that's no longer the option. The creation, the shift has already happened. And there's no verified ending. So if you were coming here to say, Sarah, teach me how to end my grief process, I apologize. We're going to talk about managing our grief process. But what's so different too about this grief is it's deeply relational. It's so interconnected with who we are as people, as brothers, as sisters, as spouses, as family members. And so this is the research I want to take and help us move through and understand and contextualize, why are we stuck? Why are our family members not moving forward? Why aren't we healing? Why is this hard and beautiful? I want to provide real concrete examples. So for examples of ambiguous 2.5 grief, think about the dark night of the soul if you're a faith awakener. You're probably possibly grieving like who you were, the choices you made, as well as like, what in the world am I gonna do now? There's a part of my family culture potentially that wants me to be the same. And yet I can't pretend I'm not here. For those who are nuanced and attending, there's this deep kind of wrestle between of like, what does this mean for me now? Like, what does this mean for me moving forward? There can be a lot of shame and feeling stuck of like, I don't belong and yet I want to belong. For believing spouses, when they're watching ambiguous grief show up, it's like, it can be like, you're physically here, but you're emotionally and now spiritually absent. I don't know how to connect with you. I don't know where our language was. And I want to normalize that this isn't everyone's human experience or experience with grief, but these are kind of some of the trends that we often see in our therapy and coaching work. For the believing family member, there's like this pause of, who are you? And there's this deep complexity for both the awakener and the believing family member of the complexity of grief. So oftentimes when I see parents working with adult children who are transitioning and they're watching them go through grief process and it's messy and it's human and there's anger and there's sorrow, there's that gentle, difficult question of, but you were always so happy before. If this is the right path, where is this emotion coming from? And what reality is like within Mormonism, within America, within our current culture, we don't know how to give space or permission to grieve. We want it to be tight, wrapped up. I think most people have a bereavement package of 1 to 3 days. If a significant person actually dies, we do not know how to do grief well. And so if this is feeling complicated, it's not because you're doing it wrong. It's because we've never been here before. But I have a lot of hope about what we can do moving forward. The other part of grief that we really need to contextually understand is non-finite loss. So this is the type of loss and experiences that are enduring in nature, usually predicted by a negative life event. I want to say negative only within the context of its experience. So a faith awakening, moving through or out of the church, culturally is considered negative, even though that could be a healthy developmental norm for that person, but we need to understand why it feels negative. A negative life event or an episode that retains physical and or psychological presence in an ongoing manner. So I want to get specific, like, okay, so what does this mean in my everyday life? One of the hallmarks is there's an ongoing uncertainty regarding what's going to happen next. What will I lose if I'm honest and following my heart? For someone who's attending, how long can I stay? How long can I make this work? For the believing spouse, for those in mixed faith marriages, will be able to make this marriage work? There's no certainty in the future. That's a very different type and kind of complexity of grief. For a believing family member, will they come back? Will we be in heaven together? And why I wanted to list all four of these examples is one, to create a safe space for wherever we are in this journey, but it creates a different level of love and compassion when you recognize the process you were going through as a faith awakener. There is a similar level, potentially, similar experiences in the grief. The connotation is different. Our experience, our questions are different, but truthfully, we're both experiencing hallmarks of non-finite loss. The second is there's often a sense of disconnection from the mainstream, what is generally viewed as normal in the human experience. So for the faith awakener, there can be, because faith awakening hasn't been normalized and hasn't been provided in our cultural education, what's wrong with me? What's the matter with me? And there's also can be this incredible desire to do what is not normal in Mormonism, but normal in the world. Like, I'd really like to wear a tank top. I'd really like to try a cup of coffee. I'd really like to go on a hike on Sunday, right? So there's this like grappling with what is normal. For those who are nuanced and attending, I'm not even normal anymore within Mormonism. I'm going through this internal wrestle, but I'm up here normal. Normal meaning attending active believing Mormon. And there can be incredible loneliness there. I think a lot about Brené Brown's book, Braving the Wilderness, for both the faith awakener and the nuancer attender. For believing spouses, what is happening to our family? Like, why can't we just be like a normal Mormon family, right? Whatever normal means culturally in that context. Believing family members have often the same question. What's wrong with me? What did I do wrong? And there's a disruption in the family culture only because there hasn't been a practice, permission. And this is where I think we're changing in this generation, which gives me so much hope. When we see people moving and transitioning and believing family members accepting. But what is really normal, what is normal spiritual development when it comes to like fouler stages of faith and other deep research on spiritual development, which includes doubt, wrestling with uncertainty, more ambiguity in our belief. So what is actually viewed as normal spiritual development in the rest of the world, whatever I guess we want that to mean too, is viewed as abnormal in the normal human Mormon experience. So this is so oftentimes why within our Mormon families, our grief is stunted. We don't know what to do with this. We haven't been trained to know what to do with this. We've been told all of the things we should grieve. Like, do we have to take an elevator down from the celestial kingdom to visit our family members? We don't know how to grapple with this. Why? It's also continuous. I'm in a hurry because I'm a talker. The magnitude of loss is frequently unrecognized or not acknowledged by others. Once again, this speaks to our culture where we are still so young and understanding grief. For the faith awakener, there's no one has thrown me a party as a faith awakener. I think Anthony and I, who run a Mormon Spectrum group here in Billings, Montana, we're going to have to throw ourselves a party, I think. But there's no recognition, which is why, and there's also no honoring culturally yet of that significance. I'll let you read the others, but it's marked by secrecy. There's no permission to honor or respect. And it happens through all levels. And so if we're feeling like we don't know how to do this as a culture and as a family and as a community, it's because we're young in the process. But it also can explain why it's so deeply painful in every single area of belief or disbelief. Another hallmark of non-finite loss is an ongoing sense of helplessness and powerlessness associated with the loss. I can't know what I don't know. I can't completely fix the system. For the believing spouse, I can't make you want to believe, regardless of how hard I try. So there's like this surrender, there's this powerlessness and hopelessness. And once again, it's because the context of it is abnormal within our Mormon experience. If we were other people who are not within our religious culture have very different experiences with this and can feel less powerless and less helpless. And that's why part of our healing is considering how do we own choice? How do we own accountability? The non-finite loss can also show up for the believing family member of like, I can't pray this one away. I don't know how to fix this one. I was never taught what to do with a child who is doubting, right? So there needs to be this just like this softening and like love and compassion of like, if we're all just showing up in fear and we're showing up and we don't know what to do, or a lot of family cultures, which is we just don't talk about it, it's not necessarily because that's what people want. It's because they have had no other training. Shame, embarrassment, and self-doubt are typically a hallmark sign of non-finite loss. We can ask ourselves, am I making the right choice? For those who are attending, like, should I leave? Am I doing the right thing? How long can I stay? For believing spouses, what will people think of us now? Shame and embarrassment and disappointment comes forward because of the fear, right? And are we our best selves with fear? I'm not. But what we can understanding that this has a name helps us think about next steps. Another is there are few or no rituals to validate or legitimize the loss. Also, often associated with developmental mile markers that are missed. And I want to kind of open this up. So for example, the reason it's non-finite, meaning it's not one specific, it's ongoing, it feels perpetual, the grief is cyclical, is because the difference and attachment and the reminders of the losses are pretty continual. I mean, every Sunday, someone might be sitting alone, both at home or on a pew. That's a mile marker. Every day when your spouse kneels down to pray to a God that is different than yours, that's a reminder of the grief, right? Not going on a mission, not baptizing your child, not being in your child's temple ceiling. These are all examples of non-finite losses that bring back to our awareness immediately the loss, the difference and our fear, which is when people are like, why can't I hurry this process up? Why can't I hurry this process up? It's because we're intricately connected in aspects that remind us of our difference, both as a faith awakener or as a believer, right? My son's not at church today, right? There's this these reminders, these visual cues over and over and over again. And Mormonism is really good at ritual in becoming a member. There is very little ritual other than excommunication or disfellowship in exiting. That matters. And that challenges our healing. It challenges the complexity of our grief. It often gets worse with time. And if there isn't a new skill set or ongoing normalization, support, and community. And why this matters to me so much as a therapist and as a sister in this journey is because without addressing it, we move straight into chronic sorrow. So chronic sorrow is cyclical, recurring, and potentially progressive pattern of pervasive sadness that is experienced in response to continual loss or the continual remembrance of loss. So I want to just take a moment and pause and see, as you read through this list of hallmark features of chronic sorrow, have you tasted this? I have. It usually happens with a fundamental change to one's identity and concept of self that isn't celebrated, allowed, or valued. There's typically high levels of hyperarousal, of hypervigilance. It can feel like, what if they know? What if they find out? I remember in one of the greatest moments of my hyperarousal during a dark night of the soul, I really sincerely wondered if I would never think, if there would ever be a day that I didn't think about Joseph Smith and polygamy for 12 hours a day. That was hyperarousal for me. One of the hardest parts about chronic sorrow is that oftentimes it doesn't necessarily interfere with daily functioning. Like, we're kind of like these little zombies that no one really knows about, like walking through our everyday existence while something has fundamentally shifted in us, both as a believer and a non-believer. Like, my child just came out as gay and no one knows. You need to start making t-shirts or something, team. Or, I don't know if I believe in God anymore. And yet we're supposed to still function, and we can still function. But I just want to name that just because we're functioning does not mean there is not acute stress or distress. There's triggers internally, externally. There can be a constant comparison of current and past selves. And without help, without shifting this, it can lead to depression, anxiety, substance abuse, violence, and suicide. It's serious. It matters that we figure this out for ourselves and for our loved ones. It matters. So we're going to talk about, okay, so we know about all the reasons it's hard. And we're understanding the complexity of the different types of grief we're experiencing. And those were just three of about six most faith awakeners and family members experience. Other include disenfranchised grief, etc. I won't go too much into it. So now it's talking about grief management, hope, and healing. And these come from Pauline Boss's six goals for ambiguous loss. The first is finding meaning. I love this. Okay. We have to find meaning. We don't have to find a meaning in the abuse that we possibly experience. We don't have to find meaning or justify pain. Or mistreatment, but finding meaning now matters. First, we have to normalize and educate. Fowler's Stages of Faith has been a huge part of understanding that developing, wrestling with doubts, moving through a faith experience is not doing something wrong. It is developmentally normal. And grieving your losses is healthy and adaptive because it's naming the significance of what you've survived, what you have lived through, what you have benefited from. One of the things, too, is perceiving suffering as inevitable and universal. If we are struggling in our belief or we are struggling in our faith awakening, it is not because we're doing something wrong. It is because we are human. Finding community that is also invested in meaning-making matters. places like Sunstone, people who are willing to sit and grapple with this. Mormon Spectrum Group has been a huge part of my grief management process, finding 1 to 3 people that you can talk about your grief with, both as the transitioner or the awakener or as the believing family member. It matters, and it actually counters and helps heal and us move through the ambiguous loss, the 9 finite loss, as well as preventing chronic sorrow. We need to move into, instead of either or thinking, into both and thinking. I'm grieving, I'm grateful. If any of my clients are here, they know I'm big into values. One of the reasons value work is so important is because within Mormonism, there's a cultural community about which values matter. We love obedience. We love service. We love literal belief. And yet, there are other beautiful spiritual values that are of equal importance that might matter to you and might be exactly why you are where you are. Social justice is a core value for me. It makes sense I am where I am because of my value of social justice in relationship to the church. So ask yourself, what are the values that led to this moment? What are the values that I can live into right now? What can I be proud of? This is huge. It reduces shame. It allows us to stand in our truth. What can we be proud of regarding my growth and my journey? We're going to challenge shame as we find meaning. I love to reconsidering the ingredients of the practices we once used to have meaning. Prayer was an incredibly important part of my Orthodox practice. I kept a prayer in my heart at all times. In the midst of my faith awakening and faith journey, at one point prayer was not safe. And so what I had to find is like, what are the ingredients of prayer? Okay, I'm like sitting down and being still. I'm being grateful. I'm asking for help. I'm thinking of others. How can I take those ingredients and re-explore them? As a result, meditation is now an important part of my meaning-making practice that is honoring where I am. For those who are active and believing, do what works for you, right? Like this is the hardest part, team, is in wrestling with our grief and moving through it and finding meaning. No one's going to do it for us. A lot of Mormonism handed things to us. Here's your gospel doctrine manual. Here are your scriptures. This is not the option we have anymore. We have to do the work ourselves. And anyone who tells me they don't have time, I said, well, once upon a time, you had 3 hours every Sunday. So we need to create time for this work, or we will continually wrestle and potentially move into chronic sorrow. I want to talk about recreating meaningful rituals. Rituals can feel like a triggering word. A ritual is simply a practice that has meaning that you create. Lighting a candle is a ritual. Asking what your favorite moment of the day each night with your partner is a ritual. I want you to soften the meaning of ritual so it feels like you can enter into it. The other is tempering and mastery. Tempering mastery refers to accepting that while I may be in control of some aspects of my life, I am not in control of this loss. I am not in control of how Aunt Susie will think of me. I am not in control of my dad's disappointment. I am not in control of Joseph's belief, right? But I can gain control regarding my choices and reactions to it. Here are some examples. We're wanting a sense of control. So I want to start first this is all about the practice of going inward and learning about our triggers, considering what our areas of competency are. And one of the biggest skills that I want to focus with our limited time is really challenging invitations for internalized blame and shame. We can hear those blaming remarks from our family members and our friends, but as awakeners, and as believers, we're really good at self-shaming. And so thinking about shame resiliency, and I included those steps here. So recognizing the personal vulnerability that led you to feeling shame. It's all about getting internally curious and really understanding our internal sense of self. This can oftentimes take support. coaching, therapy, workbooks, because so oftentimes we don't want to step into here. What we would rather do is control external. Let me blame the church. Let me control my family members. Let me wait for them to change versus really stepping back into our internal experience. But because we are the individuals experiencing our grief, we have to practice our own mastery. And I'd love to talk more about that at a different time. The third is reconstructing identity. Getting curious regarding our new roles, our status, our boundaries, what rituals we really want to embrace. And these are some of the examples. What regarding your identity have you lost? What does spirituality mean to you now? I love the permission of Brené Brown's definition of spirituality, which is recognizing and celebrating that we are intricately connected to each other by our power greater than all of us. I would love too, as family members and as individuals of our, in our family system, is what does it mean to be a good person now? What does it mean to be a good parent now? What does it mean to be a good child now? So once again, we're reconsidering our identity, our sense of self in the systems in which it's included. And it's all about getting creative. I love Brené Brown's encouragement to take things from our head to our heart through our hands. Writing, vision boards, art, movement. We have to use our mind, body, spirits to reconstruct our identity. And once again, no one's going to do this work for us. I wish that this is what I had in Mutual growing up in Young Women's. It's not. So this is the internal work that we have to own, our own grief recovery, our own grief management. And that can be sobering. And it can feel lonely, which is absolutely why we need community. We also need to normalize ambivalence. Resiliency depends on knowing that the ambivalence from ambiguous loss is normal and it can be managed. That doesn't mean it doesn't hurt, but the management of it is possible. So I want to be really brief here. One of the ways to normalize our ambivalence is understanding that if we feel guilt or have negative feelings, both in making choices that are right for us, it's normal to have complicated feelings there. Ambivalence is a state of having mixed feelings. So many clients, when they've made the really hard decision to step away from the church and not attend Sunday the first time because it's bringing up too much emotional devastation, they feel guilty. We also have to recognize that we have been groomed. That's a triggering word for many, but we have been groomed to have certain feelings regarding certain behaviors. That does not necessarily mean the behaviors are wrong. So being able to sit in that complexity will be one of the largest ways to manage and move through complex grief, ambiguous loss, and preventing that non-finite sorrow. Also naming it, naming how you're feeling. Brené Brown talks so much about shame lives in secrecy. If we don't bring those up of like, you know, I'm really wrestling, like I'm going to pretend I'm a mom of a son that's not going on a mission. I love Joseph. I just see how incredible of a kid he is. And I really wish he was going on a mission. And yet I'm gonna step into that discomfort of trusting him, right? This is normalizing ambivalence is so important, but we haven't been given permission to do that. We also haven't had it modeled predominantly within our religious culture. So if it feels kind of hard, it's because it's new. Seeing conflict as positive, that's hard for us. We're raised to be, I don't know about you, but I was raised to be very kind. Standing in my truth sometimes does not feel kind, but it actually is the kindest thing I can do for me. So being able to tolerate tension, to tolerate difference is huge. And one of those ways I can do that is developing coping tools, which we're going to talk about too further. And that's going to be with stress management. Also the gentle and hard question of what are we going to choose if nothing changes? If my spouse stays in the church forever, If my dad always feels disappointed, if my sister never talks to me again, if my friends stop letting their kids play with me, what am I going to choose to do now? It's important to give empowerment to our choices, which allows us to revise attachment. Revising attachment is all about honoring where we have been and where we're going. My friend Peter Levitt did a beautiful presentation this afternoon on like the journey to gratitude in his post-Mormon experience. And this is meaningful. It's meaningful work. And one of the questions is, we've all been impacted by our faith in good, beautiful ways and in heavily problematic ways. It is both, which is why it's ambivalent, mixed feelings. My mannerisms has been impacted by my Mormonism. My speaking, gosh darn it, has been impacted by Mormonism. My thinking, my communicating, my values and beliefs. You better believe I'm going to keep holding on to my value of love and service. I'm grateful for those. We also have been impacted by our feelings about self and others. So I want you to some gentle questions to ask about that is, what imprints would you like to affirm? What imprints would you like to relinquish? It's all about permission giving. It's, what do I want to do now? One of the most important, an activity that can be really beautiful, is a loss and awakening timeline. So you kind of look at the whole span of your experience, and you can do it with art, with drawing, with like a timeline, whatever feels right for you. And notice where there has been loss or disconnection, where has there been awakening, what has been beautiful, what has been problematic. And kind of seeing it gives us a sense of what a power in thinking about what next. And that's really, really important. Also creating connection and community. We were not meant to do this alone. And I am a sincere believer that we need at least 1 to 3 people. They don't need that we can truthfully show up as. And if you don't have those, we need to find those communities and reach out to me. Let's get creative, because we all deserve safety as we revise our attachment. And we can't be passive in this process. We have to choose. Like, it's a conscious decision. And when we don't let it be conscious, if we don't really look at it, that's when we kind of slip into that chronic sorrow. So it's important to name. Discovering hope. I love Mary Oliver. She says, tell me, what is your plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So in discovering hope, there's the permission to re-explore spirituality in the sense of what spirituality means and is safe to you. One of the greatest things in discovering hope that I ask my client is, where is your longing? Start there. If it's for community, start there. If it's for better communication with your family, start there. If it's the ability to set some of the grief aside and live back into your hobbies, your passions, start there. Where is your longing? We have to also use laughter. We have to laugh at the absurdity. We just do. So much of the process feels so absurd and so hard and so complicated and also just comical. And if we can't laugh sometimes, like, we're not going to make it, team. Another is finding forgiveness and love and compassion for ourselves and others, creating ritual. An important part of rediscovering hope is revisiting our concept of the psychological family. Who can be your family in this journey? And this is where we get into some really delicate, deep work about family boundaries, radical acceptance of what is. How do we let our family members show up and thrive in the ways they can as we acknowledge the ways they can't and stay safe surrounding that? Dream work, vision boards. It can feel so often both as the awakening member of a faith transition as well as the believing family member that's watching this huge change, that we forget that, like, what is still here? Our family member is still here. What dreams do we still have? We're so focused on the sorrow and loss, we also aren't building what is left. What is there to be excited about? And then also, are you actively practicing what brings you joy? No one's going to hand that one to you. I've been waiting for 10 years. The missionaries didn't show up with that one. So I want to ask you, what are you actively practicing that brings you joy? That is an important part of grief management. The other is intentional and planned stress management. It sounds so lame, you guys, and yet it's so essential. Get clear about what your grief triggers are. Do you have an emotional safety plan? If you know going to the family reunion is going to be as raw, it's going to be raw and hard for you, what are your plans? Do you have an appointment with your therapist before or after? Do you have a friend on dial? Do you have someone that you know, some, you know, responses in your back pocket to reduce any anxiety? What boundaries do you need? What is your plan to recalibrate and reconnect with yourself and those who are emotionally safe with? So when you really, and I want you to think about it, we're usually good at one or two of these stress busters, right? Practicing mindfulness, that, you know, maybe some quality sleep, right? We have like some of those, but if we are going to manage non-finite grief where there is mile markers around every moment that there is difference or separation, in the beginning, we have to think about stress management. We have to take ownership of our wellness. So if there's gaps in your stress management, work to build it up. And once again, it takes preparation and the permission to own and consider your needs. I want to just, we have about 2 minutes left before I want to switch to questions, but I want to just get real. Like, let's talk about real life situations that ask us to sit in tension. I want you to think about if you've been in a situation where you have to sit up, where you're choosing, I'm going to not say have to, I'm going to say choosing to sit outside the temple. For some people in their faith awakening, that is emotionally unsafe, meaning like we're in the midst of it in like an incredible depressive episode, or we are experiencing raw and sincere pain. I want you to be thoughtful of that. Another thing I want you to practice though is, are you experiencing discomfort? Or are you experiencing a lack of safety? A lack of safety, we need to make different decisions. But if you're experiencing discomfort, that might be that ambivalence training, that ambivalence mastery of sitting in tension. For individuals and clients, consider brief communication ahead of time. Hey, Joseph, I wanted you to know that Daniel and I won't be in the temple ceiling. It's not the right choice for us. We're so excited for you and your marriage. We'll be right outside rooting you on. Brief, simple, honest. Consider how to show up safely, right? Like what friend do you need on the back burner, right? Who do you need to call? One of the most important things I think on the continuum of this experience is to not shrink. So Brené Brown talks about don't shrink, don't puff up, stand your sacred ground. If you want to be there, you deserve to be there. Consider how you want to be there. Two things I always consider is, what value are you taking with you? This is about support. This is my value of unconditional love for a family member. When we're rooted in our values, we feel clear, and we also can feel safer emotionally. Also have a self-care game plan, knowing that that's going to probably bring up more examples of loss or difference. I can't tell you how many clients I work with who have sincere fear of owning their relationship with their underwear. And we have to have some comedy there, you guys. Like, and now you talk about using humor when people ask inappropriate questions. So if someone asks you about your garments, which is no longer the right choice for you, you're going to just be like, isn't it interesting culturally that we think it's normal to talk about people's underwear? Right? Consider how you want to show up. Honor your boundaries. Have a comment in your back pocket so you can reduce anxiety. Think about fostering healthy boundaries and modeling them. I wish we had time to talk about systemic authenticity versus individual authenticity, but we're just trying to be respectful of time. I have some other examples.
Sarah, real quick, you have five minutes. I'm sorry I didn't give you more warning than that.
That's fine. Thank you so much, Anne.
You can always answer the questions offline if you need to.
Okay. I would love, I'm so sorry to not answer questions. I will take all of the questions from here and take time then over the next week to answer. I did want to honor these last two slides. The second is getting real about family rituals. We have a lot of them within Mormonism. I want to ask, where are you in your healing? What values are you going to take if you participate? Show up in ways that are authentic to you. One of the most beautiful stories I had is a dear friend of mine chose to not be in her daughter's sealing. And instead, she gave her a bracelet and gave everyone in the family a symbolic kind of charm on that bracelet and said, when you look down at your hand while you're married, you know, on the altar with your husband, I want you to know your dad and I are there. She showed up in that temple ceiling in the ways that were authentic to her. It wasn't puffed up. It wasn't shrunk. She stood her sacred ground that she as a mother deserved to be in that moment in the ways that were authentic to her. Lead activities that are comfortable in your area of competency. Think about stress management. Sometimes before I have to do big family experiences that are not in alignment with my values, I know what I'm going to have to do. I'm going to have to do a meditation before I go, and I have to do a long walk after, right? It's owning what allows you to be well while participating in the relationships that matter to you. Once again, when there's a rift in family culture, so many times Mormonism is the family culture versus like a unique culture to the family of like, we really love skiing or we really, you know, love the outdoors. It becomes about Mormonism. So I want to think about, where do we need support and communication? Where is there radical acceptance that these people might never show up for me in the ways that I want to, but I'm going to let them show up how they thrive. A lot of time, young parents who are going through faith transitions, they can let the grandparents thrive as grandparents. They might no longer be their spiritual confidants. So there's just some examples of what we can do here. The other thing is the permission that this is so messy, you guys. And if it feels like you're oscillating back and forth, like I'm doing grief work and then I'm denying it and then I'm trying to figure out what's happening with denial, and then I'm attending to the life that, like, that I'm attending to my family and my work and my kids, this is the normal. That's okay. It is beautiful. It's part of the process. This is where I wanted you to ask questions. I apologize again for not being prepared within that 60-minute time frame. I own that fully. I would love to stay in touch. We were not meant to do this alone. We are hardwired for connection. This is my sincere offering because others have offered it to me and it has saved me. So please, let's figure out how to support each other. I'm happy to help find a therapist in your local area. I also provide coaching and in-person, well, minus COVID, therapy in Billings, Montana. And then my sincere offering is, out beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I will meet you there. Please meet yourself there. When the soul lies down in the grass and the world is too full to talk. I hope that this helps you and gives you just the very beginning steps to managing your grief and normalizing what you're feeling is real. And the reason it is hard is because it's relational and we haven't learned how to do this yet. All my love to you on your journey.
Thank you, Sarah, so much. We have 1 minute left, so I'm just going to read the closing and remind people of a few things because our time is up. I would like to thank you all for attending and supporting Sunstone. Sarah has said that she would answer our questions inside of the Whova app, and she also gave us permission to email her with other questions if we would like to. Please take that opportunity to reach out. Sarah, a few people are asking about getting a copy of your presentation. Some are asking if it's available per purchase or if they can just get a copy. If you're willing, there is a way to attach it to the session in the Whova app. You can contact Grace for information about that. I hope everybody has a wonderful and happy rest of their day. Thank you for participating.